right, good morning. I'm Ron. I'm an addict. Yeah, so you can see what I've highlighted there in this, that an addict, any addict, with an emphasis on the any addict, is really, what's the history of that? Of how did we get there from the message, this kind of addict, to any addict? And so that's kind of the emphasis today. First, I want to just say how grateful I am, and also what a phenomenal job that this committee has done. You agree with that? Yeah. I was getting so excited for this convention just because of the damn Facebook group, right? I mean, it just got like they'd add one more thing, and how beautiful was it? They go, at some point it's quiet. It's like 1800. Are they going to get to, and they get to 1953. I thought, now that's a little touch of class. As you may know, that's the founding year of Narcotics Anonymous. And then it's silent for a while again, and then they get to 2025. I thought, oh, these guys are having fun in the right way, you know. But anyway, thank you so much for inviting me to do this. But I can hear the translation over here. So I'm just going to give you some bullet points so you know kind of what's coming. Today's focus, I'm going to give just a little bit of information about the pre-NA environment, what kind of soil NA sprung from. I'm going to talk about the springing from and the early years. This is not the main story. Like normally in a history presentation, that's kind of the main story, like what are the events. But this is just a little background I'm going to touch on. I won't be able to go into it in a lot of detail. The other thing is the basic text. A lot of people have, you know, like when you see history presentations, it often kind of ends with the, and then we had a basic text and the rest is history. But how did we end up with six editions? How did we end up with five editions of the basic text in 5 years? Like, what happened there exactly? So I'm going to tell that story. But this is where I'm going to take the deep dive, is the impact of our first step and what we used to in the 80s call the NA philosophy of recovery. And I think that phrase kind of might have been almost lost to history, you know, like, but we were using it a lot. People were talking about it. The trustees were talking about it. What is NA's message itself? What distinguishes the NA message from, like, you hear the expression, people are talking about, yeah, I go to AA, I go to NA, you know, it's all the same, right? Is it really all the same? Or is there a distinction to be made about what the NA message is as distinct from any from the original 12 steps? So I'm going to really tell that story in some detail, how we kind of separated ourselves from AA, talked it over, and formed our own focus in recovery, and then went forward from there. I'm going to share a little bit of my own personal experience. Not a lot, but I'm going to when I think it might be a little helpful or a little fun, there's a lot of these times where I was in the room for certain things. And so if you want to hear from a fly on the wall who was in that room, I'll share a little bit about that. But I'm not going to go into that in any detail. You'll hear me jump in every once in a while and say, yeah, I was there, and here's what I heard, and here's what I saw, which might hopefully add a little interest. And I'm going to just do a sweeping overview, mostly with pictures and music and stuff of NA worldwide. And then if we have time, and it might be a little hard to have time, I'm going to try to slow this down a little bit for the translations and stuff. I normally just rip through this because I'm trying to get it, you know, 90 minutes. But we have 2 hours, so I might cut a little bit into that last half an hour. But we're going to go around with a mic afterwards, and you can ask me anything you want to ask me. Notice I didn't say questions and answers, though. I said questions and responses. You know? a little humility goes a long way when when you're standing in front of a group and they're asking, you know, okay, I'll give you the answer. Well, I may not have the answer, but you can bet I have a response to most things. Okay, so here's the first what I'm calling pre-1953 milestone of Narcotics Anonymous is the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, sometimes we skip over that, but this is really our history. When they started this thing, when Bill Wilson and company created this thing, that qualifies as NA history, doesn't it? Because at some point, we picked it up, we modified it for our purposes, but it's this that we picked up and modified. And then another place I just want to mention briefly is this hospital in Lexington, Kentucky called, wait a second, I didn't get it. Oh, was I telling you that with nothing on the screen? Okay. All right. I'm a little confused with the visual just because I don't usually have such a nice setup as I have here today. Notice that AA was founded in May of 1935, and that was just when, you know, these two guys got together and it started there. And, you know, I'm not going to go into that history. Obviously, I don't have time to go into those kinds of details. But another thing happened in May of 1935, and that's that the U.S. government created a kind of a hospital / prison in Lexington, Kentucky, and it opened its doors in May of 1935, having absolutely nothing to do with AA, but I just found it kind of interesting that it's founded in the very same month and year. And this factors into our history because our message was, well, I'll tell you exactly how, or give you a little bit more on exactly how, but this was a place where they started, it was an effort to try to do something to help addicts, because AA was at some point along the way, AA had started to flourish, and addicts were still needing to have what was going on in AA. But not yet in this picture, but that's what's starting to come. And here, why would I say in 1939... the publishing of the AA Big Book is NA history? Because from 1953 until 1983, how long is that? 30 years, this was our basic text. Even though it was never officially our basic text, it was the book that people who worked the steps and lived the program and sponsored people and stuff, it was the available book. And so if we forget that, we miss something really important, that in the history of NA, we started out very kind of, I used to use the phrase AA Junior. Are we AA Junior, or are we something distinct and different? Well, early on, we were kind of AA Junior, you know, and so that's the story I'm going to tell. How do we grow up from being AA Junior? I like to mention this year, 1941, there was from 1935 to 1939 in AA, they it was tiny. There was like three centers, New York, Akron, Ohio, and Cleveland, Ohio, and they were getting, you know, but it was small, and they were hoping when they wrote the book to get a big blast of, We have a book now, and it's going to take off like a rocket ship, isn't it, Bill? You know, and it didn't. But what happened in 1941 is they got a major public relations coup, in that they got an article written about them in the Saturday Evening Post, which was sort of, I mean, it's really hard to even emphasize how important the Saturday Evening Post was then. It was, you know, before TV and before, obviously, the internet or anything like that, it was on everybody's coffee table. It was everybody in the country, basically, is leafing through the Saturday Evening Post that comes out. So they get this major article, and AA then takes off like a rocket ship. So it just started proliferating all over the U.S. They're getting inundated with letters. So you can sort of look at that year as this is when it took off. And then in 1950, they formally adopted the traditions. They were being kind of crafted, and there was grapevine articles about them, which is their fellowship magazine. but in the 40s as they were sort of working it out. But in 1950, they stand up at their international conference and they formally adopt the traditions. And this is a very important year. Think about us. We're founded in 1953, right? And I'm going to tell some other stories where you can see that that year is really critical, that the fact that they were, that AA formally had traditions in 1950. So this, have you ever thought about that expression in the basic text? Our predecessors' hard-won experience gave birth to the traditions. That, when that was written, that it was quite clear that who we were talking about there was AA, because our hard-won experience did not give birth to the traditions. We borrowed them from AA and adapted them. They're hard-won. They are our predecessors whose hard-won experience gave birth to the traditions. So that happened during that 15-year period. Okay, so I'm going to take a brief look at some of those predecessors. The first one is a guy named Tom M. He was the first known person to ever achieve sustained recovery from addiction to drugs in addition to alcohol through Alcoholics Anonymous. He was admitted to Lexington for morphine addiction in 1939. And I notice I put in quotes here, he was also an alcoholic. He was released and went to AA because the thinking then, and in some people's minds, the thinking still now, is that drug addiction is one thing, alcoholism is another thing. So if you're an addict but you drink alcohol, you're also an alcoholic. And I'm going to kind of describe how we dismantled that way of thinking within NA over the years. In 1944, he writes to Lexington suggesting they start an AA group for addicts. So again, Lexington being this hospital, this U.S., government-run hospital, and he writes to them saying, can we do something in there for addicts? This guy here was an AA member, Houston S., an AA member whose job took him to Lexington in 1946. So he, and Lexington is, I mean, Houston, as far as I know, I think as far as we know, not a addict in the sense that they were using the term that he's an alcoholic. But he's working with addicts in the Lexington Hospital. And how many of those are there in our history? Those AA guys who helped us out, you know, who worked with us, who tried to help us get the message. Houston was kind of the first one of those to really make a big splash. And he was always eager to carry the message. He approached the narcotics farm, that's what they called the Lexington Hospital, the narcotics farm, about starting an AA-like group for addicts on the inside. And he got permission to do that and start what he called Addicts Anonymous there on February 16th, 1947. So again, he starts Addicts Anonymous in 1947. We talk about 1953 as our founding year, so let's try to figure that one out. Like, how did we get from addicts, how might we have been influenced by this little Addicts Anonymous group in that hospital to become what we became today? The first way that happened is a guy named Danny C. Look at the year, 1935. That's the year Bill Wilson and Bob Smith met, right? That was the year that AA was founded, 1953. I mean, 35. Ooh, I didn't even realize that, you know. But anyway, Danny is among the first patients admitted to Lexington. So they opened their doors in 1935, and this is something that I would like to say a number of times. Whenever AA or whenever that whole movement opened its doors, addicts walked in, and they had to deal with us. And I'm going to just really talk about how did they deal with us? What did they do here? You know, how did that go? Danny goes in and out seven times over the next 12 years, unable to stay clean. In 1947, he attends Addicts Anonymous. So that was the year that Addicts Anonymous was created in Lexington, was 1947. So from 1935 to 1947, Danny's bouncing in and out. And what happens to addicts when you try to give them treatment? They bounce in and out. They don't stay clean. You send them back out, they can't make it. They don't make it out there. And he gets out in 1948, and he attends a meeting of, he starts attending meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's some evidence that he attended some Alcoholics Anonymous. So now everything's good, right? He goes to AA, and he gets clean and stays clean, and life is good again. No, he relapses, and he returns in 1948 back to working with Houston in Lexington. So this part of the story, these bullets here are what you see in our literature as the tired old lie, that this is the pattern for addicts. We don't get anything but this. We bounce in and out. We can't stay clean. At this point, though, it was not a tired old lie. It was just in the process of getting tired, but it was still true. This is what we looked like. We bounce in and out. We don't stay clean. In April of 1949, he returned to New York City, and he starts a meeting for addicts based on the AA program. He calls it Narcotics Anonymous. So that's 1949. So again, why do we say 1953? So I'm going to keep trying to peel the layers off of that story. This is the first use of that name. The name was kind of out there a little bit, but the first use of that name in founding a fellowship, calling it Narcotics Anonymous, and Danny never used again. Danny died clean. Once he started applause for Danny is tepid, but no, really, Danny is one of the heroes out there. He was not part of our fellowship, I believe, and I'm going to make that case here in a second, but he was part of the movement that spawned our fellowship, and our fellowship got formed. And I read something about Danny's death one time, and I got tears in my eyes, and I'm just tired enough right now today that I might get tears in my eyes again. We'll see. But, Danny died of cancer. And today when someone dies of cancer, they get treated. But in the very end game of cancer is often morphine. And we don't say they didn't die clean. They died clean, and at the end they got the appropriate treatment for the condition they had. But Danny died of cancer refusing morphine until he died, because he said, he felt like his place in the history of things was such that I'm not going to let the message to the addict who still suffers be that, anything but pure. And it just, what a hero, I mean, I, if I die of cancer and I'm in that kind of pain, probably will be medicated when I die. Maybe you will too. I mean, it's sort of that doesn't mean I'm not going to die clean, but I just found that interesting with Danny. So let's look at that New York City NA that started in 1949. By this, I mean Danny C's organization, founded in 1949 in New York City, a spinoff of Addicts Anonymous. And what year did I say the traditions were adopted by AA? 1950, right? So this is an interesting little fact, that his organization was created prior to the traditions being adopted by AA. He was founded pre-traditions and never did adopt the traditions. They were directly affiliated with the Salvation Army, which they wouldn't have done had they had a sixth tradition, probably, right? But they didn't have a sixth tradition. They took public advocacy positions, like weighed in on the questions about addiction and stuff, and you can see evidence of that in some articles and that sort of thing. They would not, they took positions regarding addiction treatment in correspondence and interviews, which they wouldn't have done had they had a 10th tradition, right? They would have said no opinions on outside issues. We'll mind our own store, but let others have those debates. They sought and accepted external funding. And of course they did. You're starting a new nonprofit organization. Of course you need funding, and but had they had a seventh tradition, they'd have had to do that another way, right? They publicly identified Danny as the leader, which they probably wouldn't have done had they had the second tradition, the 11th tradition. And they appeared in articles with full name and face, although they were, they had the name Anonymous, so they were trying to apply that, but they didn't have that tradition the way we do today. Danny died in 1956. He was succeeded as executive director by a woman named Ray Lopez, and Ray died in 1972, and the organization died out. So the next question is, what were then their contributions, you know, to that soil out of which our fellowship sprung? They were the first known fellowship to use the name Narcotics Anonymous. They did extensive public relations, including being mentioned in major magazines and books and in numerous local newspaper articles, eventually TV as well. So these guys were rocking and rolling. If you look at the difference between 1953, Jimmy Kay, Los Angeles, Narcotics Anonymous, and these guys, it is the story of the tortoise and the hare. It really is. These guys, you know that story, right? I don't know if it was Hans Christian Andersen, but you probably still know the story, right? Maybe it was Aesop or something. But you know, the tortoise and the hare go on the race, and the hare is the tortoise is dilly-dallying along, or the hare is dilly-dallying along the way, and the tortoise is slow and steady. You know, but the hare doesn't make it; the tortoise wins, right? This is really that story, they also got an article in the Saturday Evening Post in 1954. Meanwhile, our guys are over there just sort of arguing about whatever and one meeting in the world in 1954. That's one meeting. It meets on Monday nights. These guys are getting major articles in magazines. They're getting the name of Narcotics Anonymous out there. So that's a contribution they made to this. They made tremendous contributions to the vision of a program for addicts. Though Jimmy and others may have gotten our name from them, there was never an affiliation between the two fellowships. In retrospect, they provide a critical lesson in the importance of the traditions. So they basically show us what we look like without traditions, you know, and it's impressive in many ways, but you see, you know, they died out 20 years later, so you really see the significance of the traditions being introduced. Okay, and this was a publication, a little magazine that they were putting out of Lexington, and it was going to the New York groups. It was going, once ours got going in 1953, we had this little publication, and you see influences of this. So you can see influences of that whole Lexington thing throughout the history. But the question early on within AA was, will AA help addicts? Will AA open its doors to addicts? And so I'm gonna show you some correspondence and some documentary evidence about how they wrestled with that question. In June of 1944, a letter appeared in the newly created AA Grapevine, again, their fellowship magazine, proposing what they called a hopheads corner. So whenever you're dealing with addicts and addiction, there's always slang, right? So this is 1940s slang for us. We are hopheads. Let's have a hopheads corner where addicts could share their experience with each other. So they're saying, maybe we can accommodate these guys. Maybe they can talk to each other like we talk to each other. But, you know, we are other at the, still. A series of Grapevine articles did appear in 1944 and 45 on the topic, including warnings of the dangers of goofballs. So now, they're not talking about us now, even though some of us are goofballs, but they're talking about, like, when you take a drink, sometimes when you throw that little pill in your mouth with your drink, it just, you get a little bit more bang for your buck, you know. And so then the question in AA is, when you stop the drink, do you have to stop the goofballs too, or can you just do the goofball, you know? And can you be sober? And is that not still an issue, a discussed and debated issue? But so there, in 1944 and 45, they're talking about, like, okay, how about the goofballs, you know? And there were multiple suggestions of an AA group for addicts during this period. And tensions grow over this in AA. And again, I'm going to walk you right through some of that. By early 1950s, AA develops what they call their singleness of purpose philosophy. Addicts can adapt the steps and traditions and form their own group, but not attend closed AA meetings as members. That becomes policy. and you know, like all of us, they don't enforce policy like get out of here, you know. Although there's many historically many AA groups do that. You're an addict in Albuquerque where I live. They were notorious for going up to they had a big like whiteboard in the room at one of the main AA meetings in town, and the first thing they'd do is they'd write no addicts on the whiteboard. And so is this saying we will not help addicts? We don't care about addicts. We'll not. No, that has never been where they've been. They've never been. We don't care about them. We will not help them. What they were saying is we'll help them by letting them take our steps and traditions and adapt them to their purpose, but not to try to integrate them into our fellowship because we think that might be more problematic. Bill was always cared about the survival of the fellowship, and he had some concerns. He tried to fold us in there, and it could be so disruptive that the fellowship wouldn't survive, and again, I'm going to show you some of that. So here's some. I'm going to go through a bunch of Bill Wilson's some of Bill Wilson's correspondence with people who are trying to address this problem. They'd write him from all kinds of angles. So he starts out, "Dear fellow sufferers," he's writing to the Addicts Anonymous group in Lexington in 1949, and again, that's the year Danny got out and started his NA. He says, "While I have no doubt that the underlying causes of alcohol and drug addiction are quite identical, it is a fact that the alcoholic himself or feels himself quite different, even a superior creature. To make the score a tie," I just love that, that's Bill Wilson classic, "to make the score a tie, it's probably true that the average addict looks down on the alcoholic. In fact, I've seen that myself. Addicts and alcoholics are mutually exclusive and snobbish." So this was an often repeated key message of Bill's that appears in many of these communications. And you can see what he was afraid of. Are we going to take this kind of divisive thing and try to fix it in AA? I don't think so. You know. So here's a woman named Betty Tom, in Los Angeles now. She formed something called Habit Forming Drugs group of AA in Los Angeles. She wrote often and tried to persuade him to accept HFD groups forming within AA. He consistently resisted her idea. So her idea was sort of like we have maybe LGBT meetings, women's meetings, young people's meetings, you know, things like that. People try to create an atmosphere of increased identity for certain group, or identification, I mean, for certain groups. That's what she wanted to do. Can we just have HFD groups for a little better, more identification among these folks? And Bill writes to her, "Personally, I'd feel glad that drug addicts seem to free to go to open AA meetings, but I doubt if it'd be wise to encourage them to think they can actually become Alcoholics Anonymous members. In some spots, we've even had violent opposition to drug addicts attending AA open meetings." So that was the atmosphere that he was saying, I don't know. I don't think so, guys. You know, Betty's proposed model, specialized AA meeting for addicts. Okay, now this woman here, this, I hope you guys kind of fall in love with this woman like I have. You know, all deference to my wife who's in the room. This is another woman that I love. She started her meeting in 1954, connected to Danny C's NA movement in New York City. So this is Montreal, Canada, French-speaking city. In the spring of 1957, exchange of letters with Bill, she tries to persuade him to combine AA and NA into a program that would be inclusive of all drugs, including alcohol, and call it Addicts Anonymous. So she's saying, Bill, you missed something. Let's fix it. Let's fix AA. Here's the kind of things that were coming out of Lynn's mouth back then in the early 50s and throughout the 50s. An alcohol addict is still an addict. Correct me if I'm wrong. And she starts getting testy with him at some point. She's cracking the whip with him, you know. correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that alcoholism is addiction to alcohol. It's addiction that's the problem, not the chemical or the drug that the person is addicted to. Yeah. She says, we've even changed the first step to say we admitted that we were addicts. So she's doing something similar, not quite the same, but something similar to what we did. So why use a word like that? So that the addicted or newcomer may immediately associate himself with the program. So let's use language that everybody can relate to, not language that divides us. You know? We have found it that it is impossible to tell a man who's just laid down his hypodermic needle that his problem is booze. Some of us have had to, like, I call that learning the passwords. You know, like, go to AA, learn the passwords. I'm an alcoholic, and you talk about my drinking, but I got to change the channel in my own head at what I was actually doing. Instead, we work from the angle that alcohol is a narcotic. And that little phrase gives us some insight into our name. Like, what are we doing with the name Narcotics Anonymous? Isn't it a little weird? You know, like, I know in translations people have difficulty figuring out how to translate that sometimes. Narcotics Anonymous. Like, you can see Alcoholics Anonymous, we're alcoholics or anonymous. But you get a little bit of insight here because they were using that word to mean all other drugs. You know, so here's what Lynn did. She took the AA big book. Some of you will recognize, you know, half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. And she just scratched out. We admitted, notice her first to cut. We admitted we were powerless over drugs. That's actually, I would say, a truer translation of AA's first step than the one we ended up with or the one she ended up. In other words, I admit I'm powerless over that stuff, as opposed to I admit I'm powerless over this stuff. You know, but anyway, she changed it. We admitted we were addicts, so she's on the trail there. But darn it, Bill, just try to see what I'm getting at for a second. I know, too, that you're only addicted to alcohol, so it's hard for you to see yourself as an addict. And being an alcoholic means your very life to you now. So I can see for myself right now that this is a hopeless cause. And I would not want to see anything happen to a bunch of alcoholics who assisted on being called alcoholics to recover. But using the word addict instead is all that would really be required to throw the doors wide open for these hundreds of so-called junkers and habitual addicts. Honest to God, Bill. You know, like, she's just coming at him, you know. So here's a few excerpts from Bill's always polite, diplomatic response. I agree with all that you say on the first page about the basic nature of addiction. Please be sure of that. That's kind of interesting right there. I agree with what you're saying here. Please be sure of that. It is the same problem. And I have no doubt that the practice of the same principles and truths will help a vast area of it. So, yeah, I concede what you're saying has some truth to it here. But now it's one thing to be right in the right time and way, and another thing to be right in the wrong time and way. We used to have a saying on Wall Street, nobody goes so broke as the man who's right at the wrong time. Did you find that interesting? He's saying, you're right, but the wrong time is 1957, when our big book has been published and our fellowship has been established since the, you know, the 30s and 40s. This is not the time to try to change AA, and the wrong way is to try to bring us all together into a program whose fundamental principle, first step, is we admitted we're powerless over alcohol. Trying to integrate all of that is the wrong way, and 1957 is the wrong time. Lynn's proposed model, an AA and NA combined, You just know that she was never going to sell that, but she was going after it, man, as a program called Addicts Anonymous. Wouldn't that make more sense than Alcoholics Anonymous? That was her take. Okay, now we're going to get a little closer to home. Jack P., a guy named Jack Prose in Los Angeles. Jack was a member of Jimmy Kay's AA meeting in the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles, doing institutional work in the county jail. So H&I kind of guy, Jack, in the 50s, late 40s, early 50s. He was asked by the sheriff if he would do something like AA for addicts. He agreed to try. At Jimmy's memorial in 1985, he spoke during the open mic, saying that in 1952, he asked Jimmy for help in this. So is this interesting? So is this guy the founder of NA in Los Angeles? Jimmy, would you come and help me with what the sheriff wants me to do in the jail? This was news in that room. The question in the room was this true? Did this really happen? Did this guy up here trying to insert himself into our history and take some sunshine for Jimmy's hard work, or did this really happen? No one had ever heard of this guy. So I'm going to insert a little personal experience because I was in the room when that guy got up and did that. I was working for the World Service Office. I went to work there in 1984, and I worked there till 89. And so I was kind of new there, and Bob Stone was the editor. Bob Stone was the executive, what we now call the executive director of NA World Services at that time. So he was my boss. He comes up to me in that room and he says, "Ron, you got to go get that guy's phone number and we got to set up a meeting with him and we got to get that story. I want to hear that story." And so we set up the meeting and the board of trustees all got together, invited Jack to come, and they all interviewed him. And he told his story in some detail, and then he goes away, and then we're asking the question, is this old guy misremembering some stuff, or is he, we trusted him, he had a good heart, a good soul, we trusted him, but maybe he doesn't quite have his facts straight. And Bob Stone later wrote a book, and he said he assessed that, he really goes after that question. Was that guy for real? Yeah, he was sincere, but we don't think his story is really the most credible one. Otherwise, why don't we know about him? So that's where that was left. So then later on, you guys know the names Boyd and Chris? Yes? No? If you were in the U.S., everybody would go, yes! Because these guys are some couple of guys who have really done the history, some serious look into the history of NA, and they present it back to us at conventions and that sort of stuff, and it's just phenomenal. They just do a terrific job. But one of the reasons they do a terrific job is they did their homework. So one thing they did is they went to New York, to the headquarters of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they went into the archives and they searched for every little scrap of letters for correspondence between people trying to do something for addicts and Bill Wilson, which is where I got these letters from, their work. So they found this. Jack wrote to Bill Wilson in 1952, July of 1952. In our literature, it says we started in July of 1953, right? So this is a full year before that. Jack writes to Bill Wilson. "We've been asked by the authorities in the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department to initiate a Narcotics Anonymous group in the Women's Division of the County Jail." Isn't it interesting that he's using the name Narcotics Anonymous even in 1952? Evidence of Danny's work in New York City, right? The name is out there. They're saying, "We think we need one of those in the county jail." The AA program and book are concerned primarily with the rehabilitation of the alcoholic. However, because of the nature of the addict's addiction, it's reasonable to expect that the AA program could be of some assistance to them. So this is sort of like an untested premise. They're wrestling with it. Can this program really apply to drug addicts? But I just want to make a note here that both he and Bill use the word narcotic instead of addict. "I'm Ron, I'm a narcotic." That's another little tidbit of insight into how we ended up with our name. They were using the word that way. If you're what we now say a drug addict, they called it, "You're a narcotic," which, it's just clumsy in our current language. So I'm going to take it out of the rest of this correspondence, and I'll put the word addict in brackets. Just note that they said narcotic there. I just didn't want to confuse things when I'm going through it. Because of this belief that the program might work for these narcotics, B and myself are taking the initial steps in preparing a program pointed towards the rehabilitation of the addict, one which we hope may have some measure of success, this with our fingers crossed. So they're going to do it, but we don't know. Tired old lie, still alive and well, right? Knowing full well that this is certainly out of our category as alcoholics, and this is what's often said in AA. This is what Bill said. This is what lots of AA members, I don't understand those people. You know, this is out of our category as alcoholics to help addicts. We've decided on a program based on the AA book and its principles, but substituting the word narcotic for the word alcoholic. And this is one of the most common strategies out there used by people trying to adapt the AA message to addicts. They would go and just take the AA big book and just scratch it out and fix it and scratch it, you know, and then that was our book. You know, like multiple examples of this throughout the history of this movement. The proposed model here was an independent fellowship with no connection to AA. And here Bill gets out the holy water. Can you tell I'm an old Catholic boy? Bill gets out the holy water and sprinkles it on it. He says, yes, this is the model. This is the model that we'll support. No connection to AA. Bill replies to Jack, congratulations upon the narcotics project. This is a subject which interests me immensely. There's no doubt that in time the AA message will filter over into these poor devils and liberate a great many of them. Here and there throughout AA, we find really severe narcotic cases that have been rehabilitated by AA, but I bold this next sentence for a reason. This is core to Bill's thinking. But in practically every instance, they were alcoholics before they became addicts. So he's saying, watch this next one. Now, by the way, poor devils, kind of American slang. No, not trying to put us down. Just, oh, that. My dad would say that when I was a kid. Somebody hurt himself on a farm accident. Oh, that poor devil. You know, it was just an expression of the day. You know, but anyway, probably the best source of information is the Narcotics Hospital at Lexington, Kentucky. So Bill's pointing Jack right to Lexington, which I'm glad to see you plan to contact. So Jack had told him, we're going to contact them and get what we can to help us. Some members of the local AA, some of them former addicts, I believe, have been working inside the Lexington Institution with slow but tangible results. Their experience indicates that the addict who was formerly an alcoholic, right? So he's there, it is, can transmit straight to the addict himself. And just look for the, look, when I first read this, my jaw dropped. I'm going, Bill is almost thinking like we have in us almost like a form of electricity, like a form of energy which can be transmitted, but it must have the proper conductor. If it doesn't have the proper conductor, you can't transmit it. And what's the proper conductor? Alcoholic to alcoholic. That's the conductor. Same drug. To an addict, that is, who was never an alcoholic. So this is an untested principle as far as Bill is concerned. Can an alcoholic carry the message to an addict who was never an alcoholic? I don't know. However, that doesn't mean you people in L.A. can't jump the gap. Is that it's like a spark plug, right? That's you know, can you guys jump the gap? I certainly think you ought to try. Though I agree it should not be in the least under AA's auspices. For some reason, here we go again, wind up. For some reason hard to fathom, alcoholics do not care for addicts. And addicts as a class disdain us. They think we're gutter snipes. I thought it was them who thought we were gutter snipes, but I don't know. Anyway, Bill replies to Jack. Oh, wait. Yes. Yeah, this is a continuation of that reply. Another difficulty you will have is this. Apparently, morphine and its derivatives does such I'm going to say terrible things to the honesty department, that it's hard to get a sound moral area into which the AA program can be introduced. Dope has made these otherwise fine people so phony that it's hard to make a beginning. Well, the lie is getting really tired. But you know, you just got to give him credit. This is what he's seeing. You know, this is what he's seeing. And isn't there like a whole, like think of Synanon. Isn't Synanon kind of this too? It's this next one. But I was told years ago that if an addict were confined for, say, 6 months to a year, then the moral faculties would return in many cases. At this point, they'd be quite amenable to the AA approach. 6 months or a year later, you get these, you know, dishonest, phony people cleaned up for 6 months or a year. Maybe you've created the ground on which the AA program could be introduced, right? So the difficulty you'll encounter is this, that of insulating these people from narcotics long enough for them to regain their sanity so that AA can be given to them. So aren't we kind of talking about Synanon here? And even Lexington. Lexington was like a minimum six-month program. You're going to take them off the streets for 6 months, clean them up, and hope that you can give them something that might make a difference. So far, no good. You know, they just use again. Okay, but look at this. Sometimes you look at our literature and you wonder where some of these things came from. We believe that the sooner we face our problems within our society, in everyday living, just that much faster do we become acceptable, responsible, and productive members of that society. You can see, this was written in the 60s, right? Bill Wilson wrote this in the 60s. You can see him countering that argument. He's saying, we can face our problems within our society in everyday living and become acceptable, responsible, and productive members of that society. A radical notion for dope fiends back in those days. So Bill puts his foot down finally. Throughout the, well, I'm, you know, I'm saying this kind of stuff back and forth, throughout the 50s. And you can see Bill just doing this battle, right? He gets tired. He writes something called Problems Other Than Alcohol in 1958. This was initially a Grapevine article, later made into a pamphlet that's still available in AA groups today. Here's a snippet. Our first duty as a society is to ensure our own survival. Therefore, we have to avoid distractions and multipurpose activity. An AA group, as such, cannot take on all the personal problems of its members, let alone the problems of the whole world. So, okay, he's saying, well, let's focus our activities, not take on a bunch of other stuff. Sobriety, he says, freedom from alcohol. Is he not providing a definition of the term here? Sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the teaching and practice of the 12 steps, is the sole purpose of an AA group. Groups have repeatedly tried other activities and they've always failed. It's also been learned that there's no possible way to make non-alcoholics into AA members. We have to confine our membership to alcoholics, and we have to confine our AA groups to a single purpose. If we don't stick to these principles, we shall almost certainly collapse. And if we collapse, we cannot help anyone. So he's just making the case. Here's why we're... And he makes the case in that pamphlet that we're not going to be the ones to directly help the addicts. But I put a pin in this statement, sobriety, freedom from alcohol, because we take this on in our history in a big way. We say, okay, if sobriety means freedom from alcohol, what language means what we want it to mean? Okay, so that's, I'm going to get to that. But I just want to share another little personal thing. I was a young addict living in Fargo. You guys see the movie they made about me? I got clean in Fargo, little city in the middle of farm country, and I was hearing this stuff from the people who were writing the basic text at the time. I was reading everything that they sent, and I was considering this. Do we really need to do something with our language like that? Does it really make sense for us to not just use the language that AA uses, but to actually come up with our own language? And I wasn't sold, you know. So I read this other pamphlet from AA, and it says this in it. It's generally accepted that the misuse of prescription medication and other drugs can what? Do you lose your sobriety? No, you threaten the achievement and maintenance of your sobriety with the goofballs, you know. So I looked at it and I went, you know, if this is it, then maybe we do need to do something different. Because when I misuse prescriptions and other drugs, I am, can I use the F word? No, I better not. I am in bad shape, right? So Jimmy K, let's talk about Jimmy K. I'm just going to jump sideways for a minute and just say Jimmy got clean in AA in 1950, and he was, you know, we call him the founder of Narcotics Anonymous, and I'm going to make the case that that title is deserved, that's, I believe it's deserved, but that's for you to decide. He always pushed that title away a little bit. He said, it's not a me thing. This is not a me thing. I didn't go found AA or NA one day. A group of us got together and started a meeting, and it was a we thing. It's been a we thing from the very beginning. So I don't know if you should call me the founder of this. We founded this, and we built it, and you are the we, and I am the we. And so Jimmy was, he had that perspective all the time. But we call him the founder because we just need a founder, you know. But and for other good reasons, which I'll cover in a second. Here's some copies of handwritten notes from the first NA organizational meetings in 1953, and you see Jimmy's name on the list. Jimmy was in that group. So there's the, you know, he was a founding member for sure. This was something you've probably seen, many of you, if you have a history interest, you've probably seen this document. But this had appeared in the Key out of Lexington. So this is a little document that establishes our connection back to that Lexington hospital. It was a purpose statement that the first meetings in 1953 adopted, and it was taken right out of the Key. Our precepts are patterned after those of Alcoholics Anonymous, to which all credit is given and precedence is acknowledged. We claim no originality, but since we believe that the causes of alcoholism and addiction are basically the same, Bill Wilson said almost the same thing, the causes are basically the same, we wish to apply to our lives the truths and principles which have benefited so many otherwise helpless individuals. We believe that by doing so, we may regain and maintain our health and sanity. So they're building a vision for a fellowship when there's one meeting in the world. And they're borrowing it from Lexington, and they're building on what they have. But here's another one I want you to put a pin in, because I'm going to get back to this too. We believe that the causes of alcoholism and addiction are basically the same. Two different things, alcoholism, addiction. But the causes are basically the same. That was the premise that we inherited, and we kind of carried it forward for a while. 1959, N.A. briefly dies. There was a personality clash throughout the 50s between a guy named Cy M. and Jimmy K. Cy was not much on the traditions. He wanted to start a nationwide network of clinics for addicts. He does full face and name interviews. He calls himself the founder of AA in those interviews. He was a baseball player, as you can see in there, a semi-pro baseball player. He was an actor. He had a kind of a higher profile. I've seen images of him like in TV shows and that sort of stuff. Jimmy starts to lose some interest because he thinks we're drifting away from the traditions. And he was going, if we're going to adopt the steps but not the traditions, I don't think I'm in anymore. So he goes, but not a whole lot to that AA group. And everyone stops attending in late 1959, and the meeting folds. So the meeting completely folded for about, the last I read, I think that said maybe 3 months or so. There was no NA in the world in 1959. And some people want to argue or make the case that 1960 should be our founding year when they picked it back up and started it. Other people, there might even be at least one in the room, who think that 1949 should be our founding year. I'm joking because I have a friend up here who she and I often debate this question, but that 1949 should be our founding year when Danny started his thing. And, you know, you've heard the case that I'm making. I think something was started in 1953, borrowing from Danny, and it flickered in 1959. And then they started it back up. Jimmy hears this and with others starts the meeting at Rhodes and Moore Park in Studio City in 1960. This is the meeting that Bob Barrett wrote about in his story in the basic text, I found the only NA meeting in the world. It was this meeting at Rhodes and Moore Park. So let's listen to Jimmy tell this story.
I resigned one time as chairman of NA before I really got going again because of the very thing I'm talking about. I resigned because we were not following the traditions of Narcotics Anonymous. Because actually, although we had meetings going for several years, about 4 years, there was no Narcotics Anonymous. Because one of the things we said that we would call ourselves an NA organization and fellowship as long as we used the steps and the traditions. So when we stopped using the traditions and it became a one-man rule proposition, there was no longer really any NA.
Well, in other words, there was no NA left. So I went in and Sylvia came in. I told her what happened and she started to cry, you know. And I just said, oh my God, what are we going to do, Jimmy? I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to have to go back to what we started with in 1953 when we first sat down to try to put something together to help others. You and I are going to have to live the steps the way we do, and we're going to have to follow the traditions all the way because we've died because the traditions have not been lived up to, and you know it as well as I do. She says, yeah. I says, are you willing? I got to have a program. I can't go to AA. I can't make it in AA. I says, neither can a lot of people. You know? I says, okay, let's start all over again then. We'll still call it Narcotics Anonymous, and we'll try to live up to the thing.
So there it is. That, yeah. And without overplaying the point, I'll say, the guy who you just saw sounded a bit like a founder, didn't he? I mean, he carried the ball. He carried the ball from then forward. He was at the center of things from then until 1982. So let's look at, this is the meeting format, the first meeting. Notice they read the traditions, but they start out reading the traditions, but have you ever had people say, we shouldn't do all that reading at our meetings? Do we really need to read the traditions at every goddamn meeting, you know? But from the time we started reading the traditions in meetings until today, Narcotics Anonymous has never folded again, has been on a steady growth pattern because we've embraced them, we've adopted them. But look at this, isn't it kind of interesting? It says, read the traditions and blah, blah, blah. Then it's scratched out. If time permits, and you want to do so, you know, so you can tell there was some controversy, but they did incorporate the traditions. And the meeting format was called the Architects of Adversity, which I think is interesting. Some of us go to a Zoom meeting many days in the morning with a ton of old-timers in it that is called Architects of Adversity. That's a nod back to this first meeting. At the end of the meeting, the leader will read the 12 traditions and then give a secretary report. So this is a little later version of that early format that we saw from the 1961 where they got over that ambivalence about whether we read the traditions or not. So let's look at the decades a little bit now. I'll just start stepping through the decades. The 1960s, I'm going to say the theme was literature, and NA begins to grow. In 1960, there's one NA meeting in the world. 1953, there's one NA meeting in the world. What do they do in 1960? They start writing literature. They write, who is an addict? What is the NA program? How it works? Why are we here? What can I do? The 12 traditions. So they start saying, we're going to have to capture our program in these readings and read them at meetings if we're going to grow, and we start to grow as soon as they do that. And that pattern carries throughout our history. Literature sparks unity, sparks growth, sparks vision. I mean, that's all the way back there. And they put them all together in something called the Little White Book in 1962. And this evolved a bit over the 60s, but it contains all those meeting readings, including the traditions. And this becomes what I think of as a seed pod of an NA meeting or community getting into the world. And the little NA meeting I got clean in, that was the seed pod. Somebody came out of a prison in Northern California with that little thing in his back pocket, and he comes back to Fargo, and he starts an NA meeting, and somebody like me staggers in the door. I staggered in the door in 1978 to a... to a little sprout of that seed right there. Wasn't much. It was a little sprout. And I didn't stay clean right away. I stayed clean in 1979. But my emotions here about that little book. So meetings, I was watching my grandson the other day. He got a little wound up, and he just said, I'm going to collect myself. He just steps over there. I thought, boy, you know, it took me 60-some years to learn that trick, you know. But anyway,